this week, we're rapping with California Scheming director. That's right, he's turned director, James McAvoy. How exciting. Plus, the usual news and nonsense on the movie podcast that has been stirred and moved by the Artemis II mission. And it's been trying to come up with words to fit the occasion, sense of wonder it has engendered in me. In the end, the person who managed to sum it up all best was, as is almost always the case, Samson, the alpha infected from 28 years later, the Bone Temple, when he said, and I quote, "Moon." Wise words, Samson. Wise words. Hello, Pod. I'm Chris Hewitt. Welcome to the Empire Podcast. You'll be delighted to know, unlike Samson, I am fully clothed, despite the fact that it's the hottest day of the year so far. Ooh. Exciting, exciting. Anyway, we're in the pod booth today, and I'm joined by three colleagues of such lethal cunning. Helen O'Hara, Geek Queen, is here. How are you?
I am delighted. I'm loving the moon mission. It's distracting me from things back here on Earth, which is great.
Why? What's happening on Earth?
No, it's okay. Don't worry about it.
Okay.
But yeah, I mean, how great is that? I mean, the tie-in budget for all mankind is really getting out of hand.
They went to the moon and they missed. They must have felt like such idiots when they flew by and were like, "No, moon!
Moon!"
But anyway, they can always do it again. Hopefully they'll find George Clooney and Jon Favreau up there. They can just scoop them up and bring them back on the way down. John Nugent is also here, the fifth Beatle. Hello, how are you?
Hello, I'm good. How are you?
Yeah, not too bad. Not too bad. Good. Excellent. Good small talk, John.
You're welcome.
So they call him, I think officially now, the Mad Titan. He is, of course, James Dyer.
I'm feeling it. I'm definitely feeling it.
I hope you're not on the hottest day of the year so far.
Every time we get the pod booth, really.
Click your finger, see what happens. Nothing happened.
Shit.
That we know of.
I am less inevitable than I thought.
You are also crushing the inevitable at the same time. Worky alert. Worky alert. We have a work experience guy in the studio with us this week. His name is, shout it out so people can hear you.
I am Sam.
Shout it out so the people can hear you. You just said it conversationally. Sam?
Sam.
Sam. Sam is here. Sam entered the room and said, I like the podcast. I listen to the podcast. And we're going to try and change that over the next hour and a bit or so. This week sees the beginning of Taskmaster Series 21. It is very film-centric.
Yes.
I'm bringing this up for a reason. Yes. Two reasons. One, the cast are all film people, apart from the people who aren't. In that cast, Kumail Nanjiani.
That's
okay,
right.
Okay. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
Hollywood royalty. Mm-hmm. The star of Eternals is on Taskmaster.
Incredible.
Armando Iannucci.
Wow.
The director of The Death of Stalin and The Personal History of David Copperfield is on Taskmaster.
What a time.
Joanna Page, who was in Love Actually.
Yes, okay, great.
On Taskmaster. And two other people who aren't in that many movies yet, but they could be.
They could be one day.
Joel Dommett and Amy Gledhill. And it's a really good season. I think I can say I've seen the first two episodes. I can certainly say I've seen episode two because, John, we were there.
Yeah, in person.
Yeah.
Not just in person, in the green room.
Yeah.
We were like hobnobbing.
Royalty.
Yeah. They had some good snacks, actually. I'm trying to think. There was a good selection of crisps.
They did, yeah. Very many, many wonderful crisps and custard creams and all sorts of stuff. But anyway, John and I are huge fans of Taskmaster.
Yeah.
And the nice people at Taskmaster invited us along to see the recording of episode two. We knew nothing about it going in. And so this was months ago.
Yeah.
We didn't even sign anything, John. This is the thing, though. We've kept this secret.
That's
the code
true.
Of Omerta has bonded us.
I feel like we did talk about this on a previous podcast that you edited out.
I cut it all out because I realized we were giving away the lineup before because I thought the lineup was going to be revealed and then it wasn't revealed. And so I cut that all out.
Yes. So we've kept our secret in the sense that having...
Everyone who knows us knows.
yeah.
But what can people expect real quick? Because obviously we've got to move on to talk about films.
Oh, it was so much fun. It was very, very fun, especially because I've watched that show for years since, you know, pre-pandemic, and it's been a real like balm. And to see it in person, it is like, it's sort of beautiful chaos, you know. I mean, I don't want to spoil too much from that episode, but there are bagpipes
There are bagpipes.
I could say that.
Yeah.
What else?
It was a long record. That's the thing that really shocked me.
It's nearly 3 hours or something.
3 hours.
Yeah.
They record 3 hours for one 45-minute episode.
What must that be like?
It was incredible, James. It was incredible.
Can't think.
Can't imagine.
Mm. Mm. Imagine you doing like a live pilot. 3 hours to get 45 minutes of interesting material.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the equation we're talking about here.
Sometimes, actually, that might be a better ratio than what you end up with.
We'll be recorded for 45 minutes to get 3 hours of interesting material. I like what you're thinking here.
Well, the sort of Garth Marenghi approach.
Yes. we keep the slow motion away from the dialogue where possible. Anyway, it's great fun. It's a good lineup. It starts this week on Channel 4.
Yes.
Go and see if you can, when you're watching episode 2, see if you can listen out for my distinctive laugh and John's brain. Ha ha! I rather approve of that, which he shouted after every joke. So listen out. You never know. You might hear us on Taskmaster. Or when they cut to the audience, you might see the back of my bald spot. So keep them peeled, folks. Keep them peeled. Anyway, should we have a question?
Sure. Oh, God, please.
Here is a question, and the question comes from Lorna CB on Discord. As Stand By Me is back in cinemas this week, the best movie quartets, i.e. films with a group or a team of four friends or colleagues of such lethal cunning.
Well, I think obviously all our minds go to a quartet. Of three men and one woman led by a man called Reed who go on an intrepid voyage into space. I think we're all thinking of the Artemis crew.
Oh, that's clever. That's very good. Yes.
Wait, is the astronaut called Reed?
The mission commander is called Reed.
And he's called Reed Wiseman, which seems a bit on the nose.
It's pretty, yeah.
To be honest.
Mr. Wiseman.
Yeah. Because Reed Richards is Mr. Reed Smart Man, but he's Wise Man.
He's even better than Reed Richards. Yeah.
As that is not a film, I'm calling Artemis Fowl.
Fine. Fine.
Oh, you've gone for Artemis Fowl.
Yes.
Kenneth Branagh's beloved adaptation.
Sadly, I don't think there were four people in that team.
I don't think four people watched it.
That's fair.
No, that's true. It was not great.
It was poop. Probably pooped out by the Easter Bunny.
It was confused on Irish geography. Anyway, let's move on.
Kenneth Branagh was confused in Irish geography? You take that back.
Somebody was, because the film was... Anyway, I'm just saying.
Anyway, okay.
Okay, for quartets. I mean, quartets. Stand By Me is a great answer.
You can't say...
No, I'm just saying it's a great answer.
It's both the question and the answer in this case.
Helen's two suggestions so far. I'm hearing nothing from you guys yet.
I've got one.
Something that's not a film. And then the example in the question itself. I like it, Helen.
No, I was just paying tribute to the question.
You're buying time is what you're trying to do. Jimbo?
Oh, God. I mean, there's
John?
The fantastic ones. I'm going to go with the Ghostbusters.
Yes.
Oh, that's a good answer.
Absolutely. Kristen Wiig, Melissa McCarthy, Leslie Jones, and Kate McKinnon make up the greatest Ghostbusters.
The definitive Ghostbusters.
The definitive
Yes, I think we can all agree.
Yeah.
That is the dream team.
Oh, are you going for the other guys?
I was thinking of it, yes.
All right. Who are, James?
Who are, obviously, Winston. We're going to go with Winston Zeddemore, Ray Stans, Egon Spengler, and, of course, Peter Venkman.
Yes. From which films remind me?
I mean, it's hard to say at this stage, isn't it? The true hero, of course, being Viggo the Carpathian.
Oh, my God.
Scourge.
Oh, boy.
Was it a scourge?
Sorrow of Moldavia.
Scourge of Carpathia. Sorrow of Moldavia. Yes, that's it.
Is it Moldavia or Moldavia?
He says Moldavia, but he has an accent.
He does, yeah. Mm. Okay. That is, honestly, that's what I was leaning towards. I was leaning towards the Ghostbusters.
Mm.
Yeah. Who are you going to call?
How about the Heathers?
That's
a fairly good shout, because it's what, the three Heathers and then Veronica.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, are they an effective team? No.
Depending on what your goals are.
But they
are.
Have a strong look and they really rule the lunchroom. So, credit where it's due. Do we go back to the early days of the Fast and Furious franchise when there were kind of four of them?
Who are the four?
So who are we saying?
Dominic.
Yes.
Dominic.
Paul Walker.
Yes.
Brian.
Brian.
Thank you. Michelle Rodriguez.
Yes.
Eddie.
Jordana
Brewster.
Jordana Brewster. Yeah.
But there were never just four of them.
There were.
No, because there was the guy who hates Brian.
The guy
whose name I'm not going to share with you at this point.
Who dies in Fast Five.
Sure. But
what about if you go to Fast and Furious? Doesn't that get you back to four?
Oh.
It's a good question. That, Helen, is the only Fast and Furious film I've never seen.
You've never seen Fast
and
Furious 4?
I've never seen Fast and Furious, which is the fourth one. Yeah.
Why have you never seen that?
It's really hard to say. It's the only one I haven't seen. Obviously, they peaked with the first one, so I just felt that you didn't really need to. But
it's sort of the inessential one.
A little bit.
It's the recess.
No, but the thing is, you have to...
If it's inessential because you haven't seen it.
That's fair. But imagine this. So, like, you've got the original Fast and Furious. Flawless. Art. Genius. Can't be topped, right?
Point Break wannabe. But
then you have Too Fast, Too Furious, which feels like a straight-to-video sequel, except it got a theatrical release.
Yeah.
But it's already got four. It's got four people as well, right? It's got four people as well.
In that?
Yeah.
Okay, name them.
Paul Walker.
Yes.
Tyrese.
Hang on. Yes. Yep.
Eva Mendes.
Right.
And Cole Hauser.
He's the bad guy.
It doesn't matter. They're all friends.
A quartet. But anyway, then you go to Tokyo Drift. And if you thought Too Fast, Too Furious was straight to video, then hello, Tokyo Drift has a film for you. So that's an odd... And then, you know, let's be honest, at that point, you thought that franchise was done, right? There was nothing left.
Sure.
You know, Vin Diesel turns up at the end, but not really a film you're going to revisit. Yeah. So it didn't seem essential to then watch Fast and Furious.
Yeah, you see, this is where you went wrong. I committed to the franchise and watched Fast and Furious, which was a return to form, you see.
But what was it? But that was the last of the...
Set the pieces in place for the glory.
Well, so
of
this
Fast
is
Fast.
What I was going to ask you, because it feels in my head, my understanding that that's the last quote-unquote grounded Fast and Furious film before it just goes completely doolally, right? Like, at no point does anyone tie a chain to a safe and drive it down a freeway in that film.
It is grounded in relative terms.
It's very much laying the grounded work for
it's ground
Fast
beefing.
Five.
Okay. Because I do recall Vin Diesel like headbutting a tank or whatever he did in the fifth one, and that I'm sure didn't happen prior to that film.
No, it's Fast Four is putting the pieces in place for that.
Okay.
Fast Five is the most ridiculous in that Vin Diesel wins a fight with The Rock. That's the craziest thing that's happened in the entire franchise. I include the bit where they go to space. That bit. But Fast Five is where I came back in on the franchise.
Yeah.
I'd not seen Fast and Furious either. I caught up with Fast and Furious after I think six, and I was a little disappointed, given the madness,
because it's
mania
not larger than life
six.
In the same way.
But if you'd come straight from three, let me tell
then
you.
Then it's a progression. Right.
It
okay.
Works pretty great.
I get it.
Yeah.
But what you're saying is we've missed our window.
No. Well, yeah, maybe. I don't know. I'm just saying. It's a foursome in that film.
Well, maybe once we've
possibly
all seen the end of this saga, I'll go back and revisit it.
If it ever happens, they say it will.
Can
but
family ever end?
Maybe not. You know,
family never dies. Tell them about the honey mummy. John, give me a quartet.
I've got a quartet that's really good. It's the Channel 4 news team from Anchorman, The Legend of Ron Burgundy.
Yes. So before she joins.
Before she joins.
Because she makes it five.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You're not Ron.
Wow.
She ruins it. She's, you know, she, you know.
Wow.
Veronica Corningstone. No, she ruins it.
Yes, I think but the lesson makes from it, that film is women are bad.
Yeah, women are bad, Helen. But then she makes it better again with her womanly wiles and gets everyone back on board. So that's good. I immediately regret this decision. I've made a huge mistake. John, for the people at home who don't know that film as intimately as you and I, who are the Channel 4 news team?
Let me see. Ron Burgundy.
Well correct.
I'm Ron Burgundy.
And three other men. Champ Kind,
yes.
I would never have got that if my life depended on it.
Rick
well,
Tamlin.
Next up, I'm quizzing you on the actors who play them, so that's going to be fun for you, isn't it?
And
Rick Tamland,
Brian Fantana.
Fantana.
That's some good shit.
See, 60% of the time, John works every time.
You are the original Sex Panther.
Thanks.
All right, James, name the actors. Obviously, three of them are very famous.
Yeah,
and
Steve Carell
the
is
who plays Champ Kind.
Brian Fantana. I want to say that's Paul Rudd, right?
Correct. Yes.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. I don't know who played. Ron Burgundy obviously is Will Ferrell, but the other chap, I can't think of the actor's name at all.
Well, it's as we all remember
from IMDb, it's John Google frantically.
Shame on you! There's only one way to settle this. Sam, do you know who it is? Sam has just shouted Dave Koechner, and he's absolutely right. Well done, Sam.
You put everyone
to shame with your movie knowledge.
That's how
good
you
stuff.
Say his name.
Dave Koechner, yeah. Koechner, yeah.
Was Sam born when Anchorman came out? I mean, I don't want to...
Sam, you look like David Arquette.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
It does.
You've got... Yeah. We should take a picture of you, and not for sex purposes, but just, you know, HR
for
totally fine with this.
Purposes.
For Arquette's purposes. HR Arquette's purposes. Just because you look a bit like Dewey from Scream.
Okay.
That's good. That's a compliment.
It'll end the same way.
That's a compliment.
Wow. That's
what? What? That was so dark.
Are you saying he's going to be stabbed like 30 times?
Oh, my God. This man has come in to do work experience and you threatened him with death?
Yeah, he signed a waiver.
He did sign a waiver. We can do whatever we like to you legally.
True.
It's all fine.
We're indemnified.
Sam, did you sign a waiver?
Did you read the small print, Sam?
Sam, as your lawyer, no, you did not.
Sam, give her a single pound. Then you can retain her services as your lawyer, and then that saves you from being murdered by us, which is good.
In English law, you can't consent to murder.
You can't consent to murder?
Nope. You cannot consent.
Who would consent to murder?
I'm just saying, if you want to, you can't. You know, like that cannibal case a few years ago.
Yeah. Oh, right. That one. Yeah. Okay. Speaking of Scream, the core four. The core four from Scream 5 and 6, whose names we all know.
Mindy and Chad.
And Samantha Carpenter and her younger sister,
Jenna Ortega.
The core four who are burned into our brain.
I guess so, because it was only three in the original Screams, wasn't it, really?
Well, was
Dewey,
it really?
Because Dewey and Gail and
Dewey
Sydney?
Wasn't part of the core group until Scream 2.
Gail, really.
Yeah. Like, they weren't the main characters until Screams 2 and 3 really got going for it. But that's
also
one of my suggestions.
Two of the main characters turn out to be the killers, so, you know.
Yes,
yeah,
there is
that unfortunate.
As well.
Okay, Dorothy, the Tin Man, the Cowardly Lion.
Oh, my God.
And the Scarecrow.
That's solid. That's very
From
solid.
From Wicked.
From Wicked, yes, that's exactly right.
This is a really good question, because there's lots of great movie double acts, and there's lots of great movie trios, but a quartet, that's rare, I would say. Like, the Avengers is six.
Yeah.
Yeah? The Fantastic Four is... how many is the Fantastic Four?
Depends if you count rocks.
I love rocks.
Five with the robot, I guess.
Five with the robot. Yeah, we're not counting Herbie.
Oh,
Herbie can get the fuck.
Wow.
I would dismantle Herbie in the heartbeat.
Wow.
And laugh as I did so.
It's very dark, this podcast.
Yeah. Well, I think once we threatened to kill a Wookiee, all bets were off at that point. Sam, have you ever seen the Wicker Man? Excellent stuff. All right. So I think that settles this question, right? I think we've answered that question to everybody's satisfaction.
I think so.
Yeah?
Yes.
And I'm sure there are many, many wonderful quartets that we've missed and overlooked. So please let us know on social media, social media platform of your choice.
Because the Beatles films aren't out yet. So,
that's a good one.
And they are a Fab Four plus.
They
John.
Are a Fab Four.
Yeah. Hard Day's Night. I mean, they have made movies.
Mm.
That's true. Mm.
Yellow Submarine.
Mm. Mm. Just because you haven't seen them doesn't mean you can discount them.
Haven't seen them. Never will.
You should.
I'm the original Blue Meanie.
You should. Wow. And he drops that reference. You can say multitudes. I honestly can't fathom you at times. I refuse to learn anything about the Meatles. The Meatles?
The Meatles.
The Meatles. I refuse to beat the Meatles. Oh, God.
That's like the porn version.
Oh, dear Lord. And then you drop that, the Blue Mini. Honestly, I cannot fathom you at all. Anyway, we've answered that question to everyone's satisfaction. Keep them peeled next week. I might go back to Instagram because that yielded a huge ton of questions. Oh, wait, I'm not on next week. I'm away.
You're going on holiday?
It's now a bad time to point out that I'm also off next week.
Oh, my God.
Well, it's Helen, bad on so many levels.
Helen,
it's
just
a one-woman show.
And Sam.
Helen murdering Sam live on the podcast.
All right. Anyway, you're alone next week, apparently.
Oh.
Yeah.
Okay. Well.
Yeah.
I'll just, all by yourself.
I'll like, just like, prepare my favourite Les Mis solo then and be all ready.
Pretending we're beside you.
do you want to have like cardboard cutouts of us?
No. That would be terrifying.
How about life-sized dolls?
Yeah. Life-sized robot doubles.
Helen's going to be like, this is what it's like not to be interrupted. This is glorious, the power.
And another thing.
45 minutes of content spread over 3 glorious hours.
We now begin chapter 5 of Women versus Hollywood, the Fall and Rise of Women in Film.
And now we turn to twats. Helen, what platform are you choosing next week for your question? You'll be answering yourself. That's right.
Let's say Instagram, since you've already suggested it.
Instagram, yeah, all right.
HelenO84. Yes, it's super catchy.
Do that thing where you're on the stories and you go on your stories and you go, hey, ask me a question. And then great people idea. Go, boom. And they
boom,
send you
here's a question.
Shitloads of questions.
Yes, amazing. Good idea.
All right, good stuff. And now we've sorted that out. Should we take a little break?
Let's do it.
Let's do it. Let's take a little break. Trousers off, everybody.
No.
Back in a few minutes or seconds. All right. Welcome back. We're in part 2 of the show now. What did you do during the break?
Oh, I had a great time. It was amazing. We were all together. We all went and had a great time without you. You were still here.
I wonder why you left for 4.5 hours.
Yeah, well, having fun.
Anyway, while you guys were away for 4.5 hours, I was rounding up all the movie news that happened in the last week or so.
Oh, thank goodness.
It took 3 minutes.
I was going to say.
Yeah, there's not a lot of movie news going around at the moment. We are recording this a day early because of my schedule. So if something massive happens in the world of film tonight or tomorrow, then we might be able to get back and talk about it. But for the time being, the pickings are slim, I'll be honest. But last week, we talked about Ryan Gosling signing on to star in a new film from the Daniels, their first film since Everything Everywhere All at Once hoovered up all those Oscars. And then almost immediately, once the podcast was up, came a story saying he's pulled out for scheduling reasons.
But yeah. I want it.
It's a real shame, isn't it?
Yeah, that just felt like a good...
Such a good fit.
Yeah, good pairing.
I think from what I've heard or from what the scuttlebutt seems to be, it's just, like you say, scheduling. It's, I think he's still filming Star Wars, the Starfighter.
Is he?
I think there may be some additional photography
right.
going on that has just conflicted because they want to start filming this new Daniels film in the summer.
Oh, okay.
And it's just a...
Well... That's an interesting thing. So Ryan Gosling, he's now a huge, huge star. He is becoming mostly a very, very dependable, bankable presence. You know, Project Hail Mary is now past $400 million and counting at the global box office. So if he drops out of your movie, you have a bit of a problem, don't you? Who do you replace him with? Who has the same kind of pool? Who has the same sort of cachet?
Leo
as
Woodall.
Ryan Gosling. Okay, thanks. Thanks, James.
Thanks. Whoa, that's
apparently, that's a solution to a great many problems in Hollywood at the moment.
Is it?
Just chuck in Leo Woodall. Yeah, he can do anything. He's a chameleon.
Is he?
Can he?
Yeah. What? He's like, it's like Marcus Brody. Like, he'll fit in. He knows all the native customs.
With any luck, he's got the grill
exactly
already.
That. With any luck, he's got the part already.
Yeah.
What are you basing this on? Just curious. I mean, I like him in tune.
Apparently.
I think James has grown bored of this story.
Dead ringer
wants to segue
for Aragorn, so I reckon he could do this as well.
No one is a dead ringer for Aragorn.
Stuart Townsend.
Isn't a dead ringer for Aragorn.
Not anymore.
Yeah.
We'll get to that in a minute. So you're rejecting Leo Woodall.
I like Leo Woodall. He's a good actor. We've had him on the podcast. I'm sure we'll have him on the podcast again. But no, I don't think you're casting Leo Woodall to replace Ryan Gosling. So you have a Ryan Gosling-shaped hole. How do you fill it?
You fill it with Chris Evans, I think, is what you do.
Well, this is a grey man.
It is a grey man.
Straight trade-off.
100%. But I do think that they have it's not the same energy, but I think they have a comparableness.
No, I think Evans is a bit more bro-y than...
He's not quite as glib as Ryan Gosling. He hasn't quite got the sense of humour.
He can be glib.
He can glib his way out of it.
I think he can glib.
I don't know about that. Evans went into space and Sunshine and everyone wanted to kill themselves. Whereas, Project Hail Mary, everyone's like...
No, it was really sad when he died.
Oh, spoiler alert for that. I was trying to tiptoe around that. Spoiler for the 19-year-old movie. Oh, my God. Anyway... I don't know that Evans, since the MCU, has had the same sort of profile. I don't think he's hit it as big. His batting average isn't as good as it once was. So I don't know that he's necessarily the draw that he might have been 4 or 5 years ago.
I mean, the same principle might apply, but Hemsworth is funnier than Evans, I think.
Yeah, I think that's fair.
So if you're going for comedy...
But he has a very different energy to Gosling. It's more significantly different than Evans, I would say.
Yeah, maybe so.
But yes, he's very good at comedy.
Can we throw a Pratt into the mix?
No.
James, would you do it?
Well, if I must.
Open goal. Chris Pratt, no. He's got the same kind of, I think he's got the same sort of impish charm as Ryan Gosling. No?
Yeah, but he doesn't have the same... sort of hangdog appeal, I think. Gosling's energy is absolutely distinct. I don't think anyone else quite has that exact combination of sort of charm, good looks, slight hangdogishness. I think
he's hard to replace. Self-deprecation kind of a thing.
Right, yeah, all of those things.
Gosling's very good at deadpan, isn't he?
He's very good at deadpan, yes.
Buster Keaton-y sort of like, you know, expressionless comedy.
Well, he does reaction shots superbly.
Yeah.
Whereas I think Pratt's a slightly more sort of facially articulate and kind of clownish.
Which is not to say that Gosling is facially inarticulate.
No, actually, if we're talking about the Chris's, Chris Pine, I would say, has the most Gosling energy of all the Chris's, and we're talking about the wrong ones first.
It's draw.
I don't know about draw, but there's a dry kind of wit. There's a sort of... aptitude for cardigans. Like, it just feels like he's got more of the Goslingness to him.
Alan Partridge was, can I shock you? I actually don't care who plays this role, because I'm more excited by the Daniels. That's what I'm really excited by. You know, these are directors who made a film about a farting corpse and made it amazing. So I feel like it's almost like they're the draw. For me, at least, if not for, you know, the studio who are putting millions of dollars into this film.
But. Well, then just for you know, ease on the poster, just think of the designers, Daniel Kaluuya, and then it's just the Daniels.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, there you go.
And then it's done.
Just get a Daniel.
Daniel Craig.
Yeah, Daniel Craig. Kaluuya. Any Daniel, really.
Radcliffe. Yeah. Craig.
All of them. All of the Daniels. And they could just say at the top, all of the Daniels, and that's
that
the whole
cast. That would be so meta.
Every Daniel, everywhere, all at once.
No one... working on the film cannot be called Daniel, or just in the interest of gender, Danielle.
Okay, you got us back.
It could be like Godzilla X Kong. It could be just Daniel X Daniel.
Daniel X Daniel. Danielle.
I'm fully on board.
This should happen.
Okay, great.
We should make this happen.
Yeah, that should happen. Very well done, everybody. All right. So, John, you don't care about that casting decision, but do you care about who plays Aragorn?
Oh, surely I do. Yes.
Oh, surely I do, my liege.
I don't know why I went...
Why did you do that?
Why I said surely.
Yeah.
Verily.
Surely. Verily. Forsooth I
For
do.
For truth.
Good sir. Yes. Well, I think this is something that we had suspected or had heard
so
rumoured
where's this come
for a
from?
While, but yes.
I think this is the news. This
Andy
is
a... Serkis was interviewed recently. Ah. We're talking about The Hunt for Gollum, by the way.
Lord of the Rings, the Hunt for Gollum.
The Lord of the Rings spin-off.
Okay.
Sort of...
Intercool.
Mid-cool.
Is it? Yeah.
And he was interviewed and was asked about Aragorn, because we have some returning cast in this
But
film.
He's Aragorn.
Aragorn is Aragorn. Viggo Mortensen
Which is
will
confusing, because
be.
That's a place in Spain.
Aragorn is a place in Spain.
Aragorn's a place... Wow.
And Aragog is a spider.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's awful so.
Cool.
Anyway, now we're all caught up.
Okay.
And Figo is the sorrow of Moldova.
Yeah, exactly right.
Is Mortensen a place?
It could be.
Probably.
Yeah.
Circus.
In Norwich.
Anyway, yes, so I don't know. I don't know how to feel about this. I feel a bit sad.
So In case anyone didn't get it,
yeah.
The news is that Viggo Mortensen is not returning as Aragorn.
Yeah. No.
According to director of the film, Andy Serkis.
And he would know.
You would hope.
He's got an inside track. But he is playing Gollum.
Yes.
Ian McKellen is playing Gandalf. Elijah Wood is playing Frodo. So there is a bit of a mini Rings reunion happening, just not with Viggo Mortensen. Which is confusing because he did say, Viggo Mortensen was interviewed about this a couple of years ago and was like, actually would be open to coming back to this character.
I think maybe that was
It's changed his mind.
He doesn't feel
And the
like
scuttlebutt, the rumour, however unfounded, was that Leo Woodall, chameleon, is potentially being parachuted in to open doors in Aragorn.
Literally parachuted in.
Yeah.
Yeah, we will have to see him open doors before we can really judge that, that'd be the audition, how Aragorn
presumably.
He is.
Just wet hair, open a door.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I mean, the thing is, if you've got Ian McKellen, there's going to be a lot of CGI heavy lifting, one would imagine, or this makes no sense at all. So at that point, the age discrepancy between Leo Woodall goes away. The question is Leo Woodall Viggo Mortensen? Well, and the answer to
that's a no.
You deep fake Viggo's face onto Leo Woodall's body.
I mean, no disrespect to Leo, but I guess that's an option.
Disrespectful, to be honest.
I'm not suggesting it, John is.
I didn't suggest it either.
John wants, him to sort of mocap Viggo. Wow.
I don't want that at all.
That's what he's asked for.
That sounds horrible.
Helen, are you mad about the boy?
He was okay in that film. It was a nothing role. I do think he's good in Tuner, which we'll be talking about in a few weeks. Spoiler for that review. I mean, look, does this need to exist? Absolutely not. Could it be good? It's possible. Are we all okay with Aragorn being recast? I don't know if we'll know that until we see the new one in front of us. I think the answer is no, but every day is Christmas Eve, right?
Surely the obvious answer here is Stuart Townsend.
I feel like that would be somehow harsh.
Bring it all back.
Right, Viggo. The story I heard is, and the thing that may have put Viggo off returning, is that he is now the age that Ian McKellen was when they made the first film.
No.
Wow.
And,
really?
And I guess maybe somebody put it in those terms to him, and then he was like, oh God, let me just go in a corner and turn to dust. But it has been a little while.
I'm not surprised.
Time has passed for Stuart Townsend too, so...
And how old is Aragorn supposed to be? Like 170 or something?
I think he's only meant to be about 80 at this point, isn't he? Yeah, he's not super old. But I do think that, I think Gandalf and Frodo should be relatively small parts in this film. They should be kind of bookends, whereas Aragorn is he is the one who is hunting for Gollum. Canonically, he is hunting for Gollum. They may have a couple of elves with him or something, but he's the guy who is meant to be hunting for Gollum at Gandalf's request to find out the history of whether this is the One Ring. This in the book takes place before he comes back to Frodo and sort of,
at the beginning, before they all go off and throw a ring into a volcano.
So there's 17 years pass in the book between the party and Frodo being given the ring. And then starting the actual
that was
quest.
A hell of a party. Wow, how long was I out?
This is like the Hangover Part 4, isn't it? That's...
Yeah, it begins with Aragorn just calling someone going, we fucked up. Then there's a tiger.
Yeah, and having become suspicious of the ring, basically, when Bilbo leaves it behind, that's when Gandalf starts looking into
you
it
must
and trying
hunt
to find
for
out
Gollum.
More. Yeah, kind of.
Interesting. Okay. So
I think I understand why Viggo Mortensen might not want to do all of that again and be, facially de-aged or whatever for an entire film.
He strikes me as someone, Viggo, who he had that experience, and obviously it's an experience that he treasures very, very much, and it's a very, very meaningful one to him in his career.
Yeah.
But if you look at the stuff he's done since...
He hasn't been chasing blockbusters. Yeah.
So I think he will be... Yeah, I think this is a good decision for him. And also, yes, you're right, at his age, his knees might not stand it. Thankfully, casting has already happened for the most part on Matt Reeves' The Batman Part 2. And this week it was confirmed, I imagine in the same interview that Andy Serkis has been talking about everything, that he will be returning to play Alfred
in all his free time from making another movie.
How is he going to do this?
I don't know. Can it be in two? Not echolocation. What do you call it when you're in two locations at once? Cloning.
Yeah. Oh, he could do his mocap thing, right? He's got this Imaginarium stage, and he could just play himself.
I think he's been in
as
like,
himself.
Yes, but I think so. You're suggesting that a mocapped Andy Serkis directs the Hunt for Gollum, yes. while yes. the real one goes to star as Alfred. Is that
yes,
how you see
it? That's
this
what
working?
I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that someone playing Andy Serkis in mocap
right.
directs Hunt. Peter Jackson dresses yeah. up as Andy Serkis
okay.
and directs
okay.
the Hunt for Gollum.
Yeah.
Right?
I'm on board.
And he's like, I can't do the accent. I can't get the voice right. And then Andy Serkis
sure.
goes to the Batman Part 2. Done.
This is incredible.
Done deal. That's Thank not what I was saying, but that's a better solution than what I was suggesting, which I was suggesting that he stays on the set of Hunt for Gollum
right.
in mocap and then plays himself.
So just during breaks.
Yeah, like he beams himself into the set of the Batman Part 2 and Robert Pattinson has to act opposite
a
hologram, essentially. Like a hologram of Andy Serkis.
Oh, a hologram of
yeah,
Andy Serkis.
That would be absolutely amazing.
So you're saying that you're saying that Alfred should go the Jarvis route and become a full-on hologram butler.
No, Helen. No, listen to what I'm saying.
Like that's what you're saying.
Andy Serkis. I know this is a difficult concept, but bear with me. Andy Serkis, the human being, is a hologram. Alfred, the character he's playing in the Batman Part 2,
uh-huh.
is solid.
So solid.
And is okay. Alfred wearing like the pajamas? Has he got like the dots on?
He's a hologram. He can wear whatever
right.
he wants.
So
are
he's
they
mo-capped.
On the holodeck at this point? Like, how does this work?
And the person playing him is
Leo Woodall. Who's playing Peter Jackson, who's directing Hunt
right.
for
this makes perfect
this
sense.
This makes perfect sense.
Thank goodness you've cleared that up. Okay, great. I was just going to mention the other sort of news story that we've heard, which is that there is circling going on. And one of the circles that is going on right now is Bradley Cooper circling the role of writing, directing, and starring in the Ocean's prequel.
Hmm.
Ocean's wow. 10 or whatever. So, you know, he has form at Warner Brothers. I guess it kind of makes a certain amount of sense. He's pretty cool. He looks nice in a suit. I don't know what else you need for an Ocean's movie, but that seems like those are big...
A heist?
I mean, yeah, I'm
a
sure
casino.
It'll be a heist. Yeah.
Something like that. Do we know anything else about this at this point in time?
Well, this is all because Lee Isaac Chung was going to make it and then stepped away. They're still trying to get it shooting before the end of the year. That's buzz. This is all buzz rather than confirmation. The plot remains under wraps. There is a script, the most recent one by Carrie Solomon.
That's always helpful.
But, you know,
is this
we
still
don't know.
With Margot Robbie was supposed to be in this at one point. Is that still
the
case?
Was this the Margot Robbie, Ryan Gosling one that
right.
Jane Roach was going to direct
yes.
and then that just fell apart?
They're all Robbie in this one because it's a high school.
Yeah, this is the Lucky Chap production. This is Margot Robbie already set to star in it. So, yeah.
It's Margot Robbie, Bradley Robbie, Ryan Robbie, and of course, Leo Woodall Robbie. This podcast is sponsored this week by Leo Woodall. Do you have a Leo Woodall in your life? If not, then get in touch with us and we can supply you with Leo Woodall. Use the discount code Woodall to get 50% off your Leo Woodall this month. That's exciting. Good news for Bradley Cooper because I loved Is This Thing On, but it, let's be honest, tanked. It did not do well at the box office, like really not well at the box office, and it was ignored by the Oscars completely. In fact, every award ceremony ignored it. So he's bouncing. Good to see he's bouncing back.
Absolutely.
Needless to say, he had the last laugh. Anything else, real quick?
Bong Joon-ho has announced his next movie. I'm a big Bong head. And yeah, his next film is an animated film called Ally. You know, Bong Joon-ho loves weird little pig creatures. And this is the latest in his weird little pig creature
duology?
Duology, if you like. Or, well, trilogy, if you count
Mickey
17. Mickey
17, you're right.
Had some weird little pig creatures. This is a blue little ocean-based pig creature. Or a piglet squid, apparently.
A piglet squid.
So they've released the first still of this movie, which is being animated by lots of good people, including people who worked on Toy Story.
Excellent.
British animation and VFX company DNEG, who've done lots of good work. And there's a production designer from Klaus, which is the Netflix film, which I really
still
liked.
Haven't seen that.
Good movie.
Very, very good movie.
Yeah.
Worth watching.
Maybe I'll watch it this Christmas.
Yeah, that's kind of all I know about it. It's sort of about this strange little piglet who wants to appear in a wildlife documentary.
Don't we all?
Oh.
That is mainly what I know, but it's out in 2027. Looks really fun.
Shall we have a guest?
Okay.
Sure. Shall we have James McAvoy?
Hurrah!
Good, because he's the only guest I have. We love James McAvoy on the Empire podcast. He, of course, is an amazing, amazing actor. Name your favorite James McAvoy film going now, John.
X-Men Apocalypse. I couldn't keep a straight face.
Wow. Oh my God. Unbelievable. All right, go.
Split.
Split. All right.
Atonement.
Okay. James?
Dune!
He's not in Dune.
He actually is. It's not in Dune, the sci-fi miniseries.
That doesn't count. It doesn't count. Favorite James McAvoy? Go.
Oh, I don't know. Favorite. I'm going to say starter for 10.
Starter for 10.
Good movie.
Sam? Atonement. Atonement. Sam says Atonement. I'm sorry. The answer I had on my card was X-Men First Class. But nevertheless, he is, he's been in so many things we love over the years. He's been on the podcast many, many times, and we love talking to him as an actor, and I loved talking to him as a director this week, because he is making his directorial debut with California Skeemin, which is a drama about two young boys from Dundee who want to become rappers. This is, when was this?
2000,
early 2000s. And they are laughed at, sneered at by the music industry because of their Scottish accents. And they hit upon a capital idea. They will pose as American rappers and pull the wool over the industry's eyes. And this is a true story. It worked until it didn't. And then the wheels come off very, very quickly. This is a terrific debut from James McAvoy. We'll talk about it in the reviews section in just a few minutes. But right now, you're going to hear James McAvoy, who popped into the pod booth itself to have a chat with me about a great many things, including, of course, making his directorial debut and getting chased as a young boy around Scottish housing estates. Enjoy. James McAvoy, director of California Skeemin. How are you?
Very well. Thanks for having me.
Good, good, good. Glad you're here. How does that feel to hear that, director of California Skeemin?
It is. I'm getting used to it. It's been a while now, but there were times where, like the first time I saw the edit of the film with the titles and chyrons or whatever they're called on it, and it said directed by James McAvoy, I was like, that was kind of nuts. And then there were times where it was really scary when people were like, you know, give us your vision. What's your vision for the film?
Yeah.
Which I hate.
Yeah.
I hate it when people go like, I don't hate it when they ask that. I hate it that it's sort of accepted that it's a thing you have to have. I'm like,
but you have all the answers.
See the script that we've been working on for 2 years.
Yeah.
That's the vision.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah. We're going to do that. And so what they want is, generally what people want is, what films is it like? What's it going to look like? Is it going to look like, what films is it going to look like? That's generally what you're getting asked.
Did you do a mood board?
Nah, I hate it.
Yeah.
I don't want to do a mood board. The mood board's in my head. And and it's in how I communicate with the crew and my HODs and all of that. But quite a few people were pushing for me to make Bibles and all that. And I think it's just to make them, reassure everybody else that I will have something. I have something in my head.
I mean, is there a sense as well that because you are an actor and the performances in this are incredible, that people just assume that you'll have the acting sussed? That's going to be fine.
Yeah,
but maybe
the visual side as well. Yeah, I think you're right. And I had a lot of people. Yeah, I think I feel like a lot of people were just asking me a lot, what's your vision? What's your vision? What's it going to be like tonally? What's it going to be like visually? What's it going to be like this, that, and the next thing? And I'd be like, I think I've told you what it's going to be like. But they want to see it in a mood board or in a Bible.
Yeah.
And they want to see Googled pictures from other films. And I'm like, I'm not doing that. I don't want to be inspired by other people's art. I want to be inspired by the time I got my heart broken when I was 14. Because that's truer to me. And even if I make something that does look like the same shot from some other film 20 years ago in South Korean cinema, that'll be because it just looks like that, not because I've ripped it off on Google.
But how do you convey that then to, say, a DP? How do you go up to your DP and go, I want this to look like when I got my heart broken when I was 14?
So what did it, like, James Rhodes is amazing DP.
Yeah.
He and I spent quite a bit of time together. And he was actually quite, I remember when I met him, he was the first DP that I met who was like, giving me a hard time about the script. And he was like, yeah, what does that mean? I don't get that. What's that all about? And I thought, well, this is good. He's interrogating the material. Also, he was a really experienced concert, like live music performance concert photographer.
Oh, perfect.
So it was great for us. But I was saying to him, like, we knew, when I had this thing, right, when I was growing up, I could have just Googled this and Googled Wild West movies, but I didn't. I tried to talk and use my words, right? which frustrates some people in the business. But I said to him, when I was growing up in a council estate, it felt wild. It felt, I didn't feel that the world was small.
Yeah.
Even though I had the artistic opportunities were limited and opportunities in general were limited, my horizons felt huge. And the sky felt big, and it felt like Big Country. You know the film Big Country?
Yeah, I do, yeah.
It felt like the Wild West. It felt like getting chased by people in my council estate felt like life and death, and felt like Dukes of Hazzard making it to the county line. There was a massive valley in between the two schemes.
Right.
A scheme, for anybody who doesn't know, is a council estate, a council scheme. Scheme one and scheme two. I lived in scheme one, and there was a massive valley or a glen, and through the middle of it at the bottom was a burn, a stream.
Yeah, yeah.
And I knew if I got to that burn and I managed to leap that burn, it's like I got across the county line and I was free. I was safe. Do you know what I mean? And it was like, that's what it felt like. It felt like the Wild West in some ways. And so we decided to make Dundee, the council estate, anamorphic widescreen, and try and go for quite big epic shots of what is a council estate.
Yeah.
And then when we get to London, change to spherical and make it much more claustrophobic and tight.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Whereas, you know, you'd maybe think, you know, they go to London, the world opens up. We went the other way. So yeah. We started big and huge and epic and anamorphic, and we went tighter and more claustrophobic and spherical when we got to London. So that was like, I feel like that's a really good way of describing a visual sort of language that we want to use for the film. All I got was, yeah, but what's your vision though? I'm like, I just told you! Not from my DP. He totally got it. But everybody else is like, yeah, but what's your vision? You just want pictures from other films. That's what you want to see. You want a mood board.
Before we get into that, did you ever get caught in the chase?
Yeah, totally. In Scotland, I don't want to use the C word, but yeah, I got my C word kicked in, as we would say in Scotland a lot, by a bunch of wee fannies or wee bams or other terms that we use for ne'er-do-wells.
Were you ever the chaser, though? Were you ever the chaser?
No, I don't think so.
It's a long time ago. You can admit to it now.
No, I know. I don't think so. I mean, maybe at high school, in a kind of lighthearted kind of, I know these wee fannies want a chase, so I'll give them a chase.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Like, and it's 12-year-olds and I'm 15 or something like that, maybe. But never with violent intent.
Why are you really chased? Because in the movie, Gavin is, I mean, Jesus, my heart bled for him from the first minute. The casting of this, I want to talk about that in a second as well. The casting of this is absolutely spot on. But the moment you see him, it's just this little boy lost
who
doesn't quite belong in that world. And you can see him, he's really struggling with social interactions. And then obviously when success comes, he goes off the rails slightly. But you can see why he would be chased. Why were you chased?
Because I wanted to be chased. I would get chased because I would provoke the chase. When there isn't a lot, right? They say, like, what do you have when you've got nothing? You've got sex and music, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
I've also got getting chased.
Yeah.
And me and my mates would often like try and find older kids to wind up to get chased from.
Would you run your mouth off?
Yeah, 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 totally. Absolutely. My special move is where I had a special move. I had a special move which I would vault. I would, if they were really close to me, I'd find a fence and I would vault the fence and they would vault it right after me, and then I would immediately pivot and vault back over it the way I'd come, and they would generally be exasperated by that and not have the dexterity to catch up. That was my signature special move in Drumchapel. It was the double pivot vault.
Can you still do it?
Yeah, I can. Yeah. Give me a low enough fence and I will evade you like no other.
We can lower this desk. This is a this is a movable desk. Maybe we'll do that at the end. Chase James out of here. Let's talk about the casting of this.
Mm-hmm.
Because I want to talk about you directing as well and kind of, you know, your journey towards becoming a director. But the casting spot on Seamus and Samuel in this are phenomenal. And the wider cast as well. Lucy Halliday
and Rebecca Morrell absolutely bring it home as well.
It was a long search, but also a quick search because Samuel was the first person you saw for this.
Sam was the first person that I ever met as a director, casting an actor. And I think the reason we saw him, because he was going away to South Africa to do a job. I was going to Germany to do a job.
Right.
And we wanted to get the cast nailed down quite far in advance because we, you know, they had a lot to do. They had a lot to learn.
Yeah.
They had a lot of, you know, hip-hop kind of dexterity to acquire. They had to skateboard. They had to do a lot of stuff. So we wanted to get them nailed down early. and also we knew that chemistry was going to be important.
Yeah,
almost more important than the two actors being individually the best actors.
Yeah.
The best chemistry was going to be the most important thing. But yeah, Sam came in, absolutely blew me away. And then similarly, Seamus too came in, blew me away. And it was just really going to be if they had chemistry or not. I tried a lot of actors and we tried a lot of combinations of actors to find this chemistry. And Seamus and Sam were front runners, like massively anyway. And this is no disrespect to anybody else that came in and auditioned. You were all brilliant. Just it's about sometimes being right for the part, even though you're brilliant, you might not be right for the part. And also having the chemistry. When I finally put Seamus and Sam together, who were the two of the front runners, they kind of cancelled each other out and it actually wasn't very good. And I was like, oh no, oh no, this is a disaster. And I think they went the second time and they were brilliant.
What changed?
I think the first time I didn't do anything.
Right.
I just did that classic thing the directors do, which is, I don't know why it's not working. I think we'll go again. And so we went for another take and they were brilliant. And I think what was happening on the first pass, because I watched it, I've got it on tape, was they were just a bit, they were both a bit like, oh God, you're good. Oh God, you're on my level now.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, you're maybe, are you better than me? Are you better than me? Am I as good as you? I might need to up it here. I might need to up it. And they were both kind of thinking the same thing. They both got a bit shocked by the quality of the other performer. And then the second take, they did it. They both just fronted up and they both went to another level that they hadn't achieved yet. So it was amazing watching that. But Lucy Halliday, first tape I saw, she was the first tape I saw for that role. And there was somebody else that came in actually who was really close, but I was like, I think it's going to be her.
Yeah.
Weirdly, Rebecca Morrell, who plays Tessa, that role was the only role that we invented. It was the only role that we created.
Yeah.
And that was really difficult. Like, there was a couple of people who could do it, but they were maybe like too old for the role or the wrong chemistry, the wrong kind of background. And nobody was really doing it to the point where me and the writers were kind of going, like, have we created a crap role here? Have we written something really bad? We think it's really good. And then Rebecca came in and absolutely blew us away. And she's so entertaining and got so much vivacity. I think that to go up against the two boys who've got a lot of ammunition, the two performers, Seamus and Sam, who play Gavin and Billy, they've got a lot of ammunition to give some like barnstorming big performance.
Yeah,
how Lucy and Rebecca stand up to them is unbelievable, really. And I don't know how they do it, but it's about screen presence and it's about internal life energy as well. It's not just about the writing and all that. It's about them as performers just being absolutely present and not withering in the face of these quite overwhelming performances from Seamus and Sam.
I always think that auditioning both sides is about faith, right? So you are seeing people, I don't know how much Samuel and Seamus did and how varied their audition was, but
they taped and then they both auditioned in person twice.
Okay. And were they doing varied scenes? Because, you know, were they running the emotional gamut in that? Because that is something as a director you have to kind of take on faith a little bit, right?
Yeah. No, I was definitely making sure they could do it.
Yeah.
And I was quite forthright and I was quite brutal with Seamus on his first audition. And because I could tell he was Seamus didn't do the best job in his first audition, but he was still the best actor.
Yeah.
But I was like, I also need you to do the best job. So make sure you do the best job when you come back as well. And he did, and he was incredible, and he blew me away. And I don't know what the reason for that was. I'm not casting any aspersions, and it wasn't lack of professionalism or anything like that.
Mm.
Just something, I could tell he was going to be the best actor. He just needed to come in and hit it on purpose.
Mm.
And he did. And I remember the email I sent, I don't know if it was an email or I sent him a voice note or I sent him a video or something like that through his agent. I remember being pretty brutal. And that's sort of like what you need to be able to, as an actor anyway, I think you need to be able to take notes like that and not wither, take them and thrive on them and live from them. And because really, you know, some of the best notes I've had are an audience leaving in the middle of a stage performance. Do you know what right. I mean? That's my note. I don't need another note after that.
Where did that last happen?
That happened in 1983. No, that happened. that happened a few times on stage. Yeah. And look, I'm not saying that not everything's for everybody, but
they might have a train to catch. But
audience, you know, when an audience ain't loving something,
yeah.
You know what I mean? And it's like, it's a strong note. Anyway, the harsh notes are sometimes the best ones. I don't know why I was saying that to you. You were saying it's an act of faith. It is faith, but I was definitely putting them both through the ringer to make sure I could get, you know, there was as little faith as needed as possible in that decision.
This journey of yours, as we said at the beginning, you know, to being James McAvoy, director of California Scheming. I know this movie started for you about 3.5 years ago, mm-hmm. but were you thinking about making the leap up before that?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it for a long time. I should have probably done it in my 30s, but I was busy with, you know, having kids and actually earning money as an actor, which is not to be sniffed at. It doesn't happen all the time for most actors. And I don't earn anything as a director. So there was that. And then just waiting for the right story and desperately wanting to tell stories about people from lower income backgrounds that are still movies, not just gritty independent film. And if there is a semantic sort of difference there, it's that for me. I wanted to make a movie about these guys.
Oh, it's there from the beginning with the chase scene. And
yeah,
you got the...
do you know what I mean? So that was when I was waiting for the right thing. I didn't necessarily need it to be Scottish either, but I'm really glad that the first thing that satisfied that desire was Scottish, because it felt amazing being there, telling that story. It felt like, I think this film isn't breaking a lot of, like, it's not tearing up the rule book in terms of narrative. It's a narrative we kind of know. It is a sort of success story that has a bit of a secret tragedy at the end.
Yeah.
And we kind of know what the structure of the film is. Also, the nature of musical biopics is that there is often a kind of a troubled artist somewhere along the way and all that.
Yeah.
But it's a deeply kind of personal and, to me, authentic movie, because it just feels like what my childhood was like a lot as well. And what coming out of my childhood and trying to find my way in the business as an actor in those early years of 19, 20, 21. And the much less sensational path that I've had to walk, that is not worthy of making a movie, but where they had to sacrifice their authenticity and their integrity to get where they wanted to get. I've definitely had to walk that line for 30 years. So coming from where I come from and walking the path that I've had to walk for 30 years, this film feels incredibly personal to me.
Has walking that path got easier over the years?
Yeah, because it's previously, in younger days or earlier days, you know, you're dangled. The thing that's dangled in front of you is you can have this. You can have success if you do this. And you don't know. You've got no experience to know that, well, I don't need to do that. I'll be all right if I don't do that. So the quandary is there. I generally fell on the side of backing myself and doing what I wanted to do.
Yeah.
But now it's very easy to make those decisions, because I just go, cheers, mate. Heard it all before. Thank you very much. I've had a nice career up until now, and I've pretty much stayed true to myself. But there is a pull to, at times, sacrifice something of your authenticity and integrity. And I think that's fine, by the way. Honestly, I'm like, get what you want to get and do what you want to do. Mm. Sacrifice whatever you want to sacrifice to get what you want. But at some point, you're going to need to pay the price, and you might not have enough change in your pocket to pay that price, and you're going to be really hurt. Or maybe you will have enough change in your pocket, because maybe for you, the price isn't that high. maybe those things aren't so important to you. So it's not like everybody's got to stay true to themselves. Everybody's got to remember where they're from. Everybody's got to have integrity. You don't. Do what you want. But sometimes people get hurt because they can't pay the price.
Yeah.
For the decisions they've made, you know.
Yeah. Did you come close to losing your soul back in the day? Did you come close to making that sacrifice?
No, look, there was the big moment for me was sort of after having done the whole campaigning thing very early in my career for Forrest, for Last King of Scotland.
Yeah, yeah.
And do it for the film as well, but really we were like pushing him so hard and he deserves everything he got. Then going back a few years later to do it all again for Atonement, and I was like, I can't do this. Can't do it. And there was a lot of pressure on me to do it. And I was just like, it's just soul destroying. I can't. And I don't mind. I'm an actor. I don't mind. Put a spotlight on me. I will dance monkey dance, right?
But you'll leap over a desk if you have to.
But shaking hands and dancing monkey dance to get votes and stuff, I was like, this feels awful.
Yeah.
Yeah.
On that note, it's been a pleasure as always. If I lower the desk, can I interest you in a double pivot?
Yeah. Yeah, man, my special move.
Yes. Special move. All right, James McAvoy, it's been a pleasure. Thanks.
Thank you. Cheers.
Okay, that was James McAvoy, director of California Schemin', and he is also in the film briefly. Very good as well. Isn't he, Hellsbells?
He is, yeah. I had a nice time with this. So, like you say, it's the two Scottish rappers played by Samuel Bottomley and Seamus MacLean Ross who go down to London. You know, they're auditioning, they're sending in, they're sort of calling up record companies, they're sending in tapes, and they just keep getting nowhere until the day they decide to pretend that they are Californians, that they like know D12, like they're on the whole scene, and then they just happen to be here in the UK, and everyone is sort of intrigued. They sort of suddenly seem to get the success that they've been chasing, and then it's a matter of how long can they keep up the facade.
Yeah.
This is based on a true story, so people out there, probably not Sam, who's too young, may remember it happening, may even have seen them, you know, or heard the song. I didn't remember this, but like, I'm guessing people in Scotland, people up near Glasgow, might have a better recollection
or
of
Dundee.
These. Or Dundee, sorry, mm-hmm. Yes. May have a better recollection of Syllable and Brains, which was their nom de rap.
Because one's called Billy and one's called Gavin Bain.
Gavin.
So Gavin Bain was brained and Silly Billy.
This is the Scottish equivalent of rhyming slang, presumably.
It is, James. Yes.
Yeah. And it's just quite... It's an interesting film. I thought it was very charmingly performed by MacLean Ross and Bottomley. I thought it was a really solid direction from James McAvoy, just in terms of, you know, as a first film... He's got a real feel for, obviously, like the time that they grew up in, the place that they grew up in, the characters themselves. I just think it feels a bit by the numbers, even though it's based on a true story, which I had no knowledge of. I sort of felt I knew what was coming in the script. You know, it felt quite sort of planned out almost, you know, or certainly familiar beats to this kind of story. People who have, you know, made a ridiculous lie like this don't tend to end well in films like this. And so I sort of kind of was waiting for certain things to happen, and they kind of did happen on time. So even though it's based on a true story, I find it kind of predictable in a way that I was disappointed by. But everything else about it, I find really quite charming. I find the music was good, the performance was good, just the sense of place and time, and you know, the excitement of getting on like music TV and selling records and being on radio and everything that used to happen before the bottom fell out of the music business, like everything else. You know, it's all kind of there, and it's really well portrayed, and I really, really enjoyed all of that. I thought McAvoy's little acting role was actually really good as well. He reminds you why he's a star and sort of swaggers in and chooses up proceedings for a few minutes at a time, you know?
Yeah, he dominates the scenes he's in.
He really does.
But without doing much.
No, not at all. He's not
overacting.
He's not glory hogging for himself at all. I think he gives real, you know, real room for these two young actors to shine and to create this sense of, you know, lifelong besties and buddies who are suddenly put, you know, their relationship is put under real, real pressure because one of them, Billy, has a girlfriend back home, Lucy Halliday. And so he's, you know, he doesn't necessarily want to keep up the facade forever when they're sort of in this situation where they kind of get caught up in their own hype and don't quite know what to do about it. So I thought that kind of side of things was great and really enjoyed it. But yeah, overall, it feels like a sort of high three to me, which I think is what we've given it.
I actually might be in the four category.
Okay.
I think this is a very, very promising debut behind the camera from James McAvoy. As is often the case when you have an actor turning director, the performances are absolutely excellent across the board. The main two guys, Samuel Bottomley and Seamus MacLean Ross, who were on, will be on next week's episode of The Interviews, an absolutely raucous, unhinged interview I did with them, which I had to record on my phone. So hopefully we'll make the sound quality work. They are terrific together, and the film doesn't work if you don't buy into them. I think it may be because in real life there was a bittersweet ending to the tale. The movie switches tones in the last half hour or so, but the first hour for me was joyous, just watching these two guys kind of trying to game the system and come up with this way around things. So yes, very much enjoyed it. For me, we gave it 3. I'd go slightly higher. Helen would go slightly higher, but also within the confines of 3. 3 stars then for California Skeemin'. Next up, James, a horror film about a podcast.
I can only suspend my disbelief so far. Such a thing could not exist. However, writer-director Ian Tursun has made his movie debut with this. This is Undertone, and it is an A24 horror film about a podcast. It stars Nina Kiry as Evie, and it is, to all intents and purposes, a one-woman show. She is basically the only person in this film. Her mother, played by Michelle Duquet, is in it, but she is non-verbal and essentially almost comatose in a bed throughout the entire film. So it's basically just her. And she runs a podcast, or she does a podcast called Undertone with her friend, Justin, played by Adam DeMarco, or rather the voice of Adam DeMarco. And it's a supernatural podcast where they look at mysteries and scary things that have happened in the world via the internet. And they come across an email with 10 distinct audio files in it. And those audio files seem to show the, is it possession? Is it something else? Certainly supernatural activities happening to a married couple. And the way they explore this mystery is by listening in forensic detail to the individual audio files and trying to pick out what's going on. So you've got sort of scary noises. You've got kids' nursery rhymes being played backwards for hidden messages. And the whole film essentially revolves around this very sort of simple performance of her talking into the microphone in that way that, well, hopefully we're doing at the moment, that sort of ASMR, slightly sonorous, very closed studio sound where it feels very intimate with the voices in your ear. So you feel very close to the action in this. And an interesting device is that she's moved back to her mother's house. Her mother is terminally ill. She's dying. It's sort of palliative care. And because she is there with her mother, she's in a different time zone to Justin. So when they record the podcast, they do it at 3 a.m., which is what we do when we can't get a studio booking, but they have to do it by necessity. So you have kind of that slightly scary nighttime-y feel. But really, the actual horror story here is quite simple. And on paper, it's not really that good. But what makes this stand out is the extraordinary audio mix, which you'd hope for a podcast-related horror film, right? And for someone who spends a lot of my time listening to, well, let's be honest, Boyd Do Lips Max, but who listens to audio all the time, there's something about this I found quite triggering, like kind of scary, just like really crept into the back of my mind, because this was made for, I would think, $500,000. So absolutely nothing. Tursun shot it in his own childhood home. Like, it's really, really low budget, but the Atmos mix is fucking off the chain. Like, exactly that, yes. The 3D placement of very unnerving sounds, from clicks and groans to music, nursery rhymes, to even sounds that just feel incongruous, like they shouldn't be there. And she even makes really good use of the absence of sound. Like, there's a noise cancelling thing as well, where you have that complete silence.
Freaky.
And it's really, really unnerving. And the way it's shot is also kind of very discordant. There's lots of Dutch angles in it and rotating camera work. It's really, really unnerving in a way that, honestly, I think the closest thing to it really was probably like Blair Witch Project, where it just it has that slightly lo-fi.
Wow, that's high praise.
But genuinely, this is a really fucking frightening film. It's incredibly unsettling, creepy, unnerving. When I finished watching it, I was in that kind of weird liminal space where you're just not quite sure what's real and what's not real, and you're kind of looking around for noises and things. But yeah, this creeped me out massively. John, you reviewed this. You gave this 4 stars.
Yes.
I think it's probably a 3-star horror film, but with an absolutely 4-star sound mix, if that makes sense.
Yeah.
Because I think the sound is the hero here. It's the main star of this film, and it's incredibly effective.
I slightly disagree, because I think the way it's shot is also really, really a part of this, because there's a lot of moments where she's like sitting at the table, like, you know, with her noise cancelling headphones on, so she can't hear if anything creeps up behind her, which really upset me. And there's just black space behind her. That, you know, the shooting of the film is often like through doors, or there's like just blank spaces or dark shadowy corners in the frame almost all the time, and you are sitting there waiting for the inevitable twitch of movement, or, you know, sudden shift in the shadows, or something to emerge from the darkness. And it is, you're doing all the work in this film. I mean, honestly, I'm surprised it was even 500,000. I think most of that did go on the sound mix. I think you're right, because it is so, it feels like a movie where he's gone, how could I make, you know, a movie as cheaply as possible that no one can take away from me, that I can just really show what I can do. And then done that, you know, he's made it, he's made a virtue of all the constraints that he's working with. But the fact that there is just so much empty space around her all the time freaked me the hell out. But you're doing all the heavy lifting of scaring yourself, I think, as you watch this movie. And but you will be scared.
Imagine how you'll feel next week when you're in the studio on your own, surrounded by empty space.
I'm just going to turn all the lights up to maximum.
And that thing that's behind you right now.
Oh, that, don't worry about that.
I wouldn't worry about it. I'm sure it'll be totally fine.
He's here all the time.
Oh, sorry, I was talking about John.
Hey!
John, you reviewed this film, you gave it 4 stars.
Yes.
Yes,
good. I think I agree with
myself.
That. Yes. It's interesting. I wonder how I will feel about it if I watch it like on a laptop. I think this is a film
meant to be seen.
That really benefits from like a big screen booming 3D sounds sort of surrounding you. It's a profoundly unsettling experience in the best possible way.
How does it compare to something like, whenever I heard the plot, it sounds a little bit like maybe there's elements of Barbarian Sound Studio little bit.
Yeah, I think that's a good sort of point of comparison, especially in the way that it sort of descends into a kind of ambiguous madness as the film goes on. Like it doesn't feel like, both of those films don't really resolve in a way that is like straightforward. And I think that some people might trip up at that. But I really like that. I also like that it's basically a film about Catholic guilt, which, as a, you know, lapsed Catholic, I'm here for. I always love a bit of Catholic guilt. You know, that there's a very scary Virgin Mary statuette that keeps popping up.
It's a different saint, I think, but it's terrifying.
Oh, is it? Okay.
It's absolutely fucking disturbing.
You really are lapsed, John.
Yeah, it's been a while. No, it's just very, very effective. And yeah, I do really think you need that big, grand cinematic experience to fully appreciate it.
From a podcasting point of view, is it accurate podcasting?
I
or is it like the people from Halloween, David Gordon Green's Halloween, who record an interview by waving a recorder at someone from 20 feet across
the room? This is something that drives me out. To be fair, with the only thing, she doesn't have a pop shield.
She doesn't have a pop
shield.
Other than that,
spot on, I thought. Yeah,
I think the pop shield is the big thing for me.
Yeah, it's not like nobody wants this, where they don't even wear headphones. So I'm like, for fuck's sake, you're off mic.
My God.
I was fine with this.
Only Murders in the Building. I mean, I stopped watching it because I thought the show was going downhill. But also, the way they record podcasts just gave me the conniptions.
No, absolutely not.
Absolutely not.
Yeah, I don't know how their sound mix works, but it does. I love Only Murders still. Anyway.
Good.
This is scarier than Only Murders in the Building.
Scarier than Only Murders in the Building. All right, 4 stars then for Under Tonnet. John.
Yes.
François Ozon is back.
Oui.
He's back.
Il est retourné.
Avec un...
L'étranger?
Non?
L'étranger.
Merde. L'étranger?
L'étranger. L'étranger?
Oui.
She said,
yeah.
That was a mistake.
Oh, you made a mistake. Helen made the mistake.
Wow.
Oh, my God.
I mean, I'm a lapsed Duolingo player as well, so I don't know. I very much had to watch this with subtitles. But yes, The Stranger.
The Stranger, yes. Yes, François Ozon.
François Ozon's latest film, which is an adaptation of the classic Albert Camus.
Camus, yes. Carry on, follow la Camus.
The classic novel by Albert Camus.
You're going to be saying English Kniggets in a second, aren't you? You're going to go, your father was a hamster and your mother smelled of elderberries, yes, or whatever it is. I always get that wrong and I'm such a big Python
fan. Anyway. Albert Camus and his famous 1942 novel, The Stranger, which I read as a teenager and I think a lot of people read as teenagers. It's a classic.
Existential angst,
exactly. It's like the world means nothing and it's all meaningless kind of book. And there's been a couple of attempts to bring this book to the screen. It's quite a hard film to adapt. I think this is probably the best possible version of that book you could make for the big screen. It's very faithful. Sometimes word for word, I think the script is, but also tries to bring it up into the modern day in a way. I mean, the book is, so it's set in...
Yes, what is it about and who's in it?
Let's start with that. It's set in the 40s. It's set in French Algeria. So this is Algeria when it was still part of France. It's a French colony. And there is a man called Meursault, who, and this is played by Benjamin Voisin. I think Voisin is French for neighbour.
Mm-hmm. It is.
So it's Benjamin Neighbour.
Benjamin Neighbour.
He'd be known here. So Meursault is a man who seems very indifferent to life, very nonchalant. He is essentially like, what does it matter? What does anything matter? He is the embodiment of the word buff. Mm. Yes. and we meet him going to his mother's funeral and he doesn't seem to show any emotion at his mother's funeral. He just smokes a lot of cigarettes and drinks a lot of coffee, basically very French. And then...
Well, that's a stereotype, John.
I mean, come on, man. He literally does that.
They all do. So
yeah.
Okay.
And then he just carries on with his life. He meets a beautiful woman and starts, you know, dating her, goes to the cinema, just sort of carries on with his day. Then on the beach one day, he shoots an Arab man in cold blood 5 times. And then the second half of the book and the second half of the film is essentially his trial for murder. Where he is questioned on his indifference towards life, why he seems just so sort of, and the book is, and the film is sort of trying to show the absurdity of this trial where it's more shocking that he shows indifference to his mother's funeral and less shocking that he murdered an indigenous man in cold blood. And what Ozon is doing very well, first of all, he shoots it all in black and white. Mm-hmm. It looks beautiful. It's very crisply shot. There's amazing like contrast and shadows and light, and that really sort of like hammers home this sense of you know, indifference, this sort of angsty mood and atmosphere. And Benjamin Voisin, really impressive in this role as just being like, he's not inhumane. He's not totally a sociopath, but he has this very strict sort of sense of life where he just doesn't care. If he thinks it doesn't matter, he will show no sort of emotion. Mm. He shows no remorse for this murder. Okay. He is not interested in sort of a standard set of morals, essentially. It's a very slow burn sort of film. It's very thoughtful. It's incredibly French. Not a ton happens in a lot of ways. If you're not familiar with the book, maybe you should read the book first. I think it's really worth reading. But I was just very enamored with it. I thought it was really impressive, very dark and very French.
Very dark and very French.
Très bien, as they say.
Très bien. He is a good neighbor in this one.
Yes.
What do we give it?
4 stars.
4 stars or 4 étoiles.
Très bien.
Oh, okay.
Wow. Oui, my apologies to all our French listeners for the way John just mangled the French language.
Desolé.
And also our stereotypes.
Pardon.
Yes. Yes. Very sorry. Very, very desolate indeed.
Yeah.
All right, last but not least, but probably least, is the rom-com You, Me, and Tuscany, which was once called Helen Italiana. And that is a better title.
I think they're both quite bad.
I think you're quite bad.
Wow. Harsh. This is the new film from director Kat Coiro, who did bits of She-Hulk. She did Marry Me, which I quite like because I like J-Lo and rom-com.
Owen Wilson and J-Lo, yeah.
Yeah. It's written by Ryan Engel and Kristen Engel. He did things like Rampage and Nonstop before now, which may explain why the script is so mechanical. This stars Halle Bailey as Anna, who is this woman in New York. She's been kind of just getting by since the death of her mum sort of derailed her dreams of becoming a chef. And she's just kind of still dealing with her trauma and her grief and not really moving on with her life. And one night she meets a dishy Italian man in a bar, and they get talking about his house in Tuscany. And he encourages her to take the trip she always planned to take to Italy and, you know, go and cook some Italian food in Italy. And she's like, you know what? I'm going to go to your town. It sounds awesome. And then she gets there and the hotels are full. So she basically lets herself into his house because she knows it's empty and decides to take it over. And then through a series of events, everyone thinks she's his fiance and she doesn't disabuse him of this notion, which is a real problem when she falls in love with his cousin who's been raised like his brother, who is Michael, played by Reggae John Page.
Who's an Englishman raised in Italy.
Raised by Italians.
Who still has his English accent.
Yes, but can also speak Italian. Not too badly, as far as I could tell.
Helen, you speak a little bit of Italian.
Si.
What is Italian for while you were sleeping but without the coma?
Well, it's You, Me, and Tuscany is the answer to that. Yeah. It's not even that good. And I like both these stars. I really do. But this is not even Netflix level. Like the contrivances and the situations and the ridiculous, like, you know, furniture that kind of keeps throwing them together, and that keeps delaying her inevitable coming clean to the family is just so badly done in this film. And the characterization is pretty bad. And the fact that the film is very, very kind of small C conservative, that it doesn't even, you feel like it was made to start off with that she had a, you know, one night stand with this Italian guy in New York. But I think the moment I knew this film was going to be bad was when she didn't sleep with him. And I mean that not because I think she should have been, you know, shagging him around herself, but because then I knew this film was going to pull its punches at every possible moment. And it was going to fail to give its characters any real depth or any real reason not to be together or any real impediment to the big romantic finale. And that's kind of what it keeps doing. It keeps like shying away from giving them any character depth or interest whatsoever and not really allowing them to kind of grow as people. And look, they do their best, I think, with what they're given. Both of them, you know, are orphaned and they sort of bond over that. And there's some nice little moments in the quieter scenes, but there's so much stupid shit around that that it's really hard to get past. And look, I know that the romance genre and many other comedy and kid genres do this a lot, which is to stereotype countries and areas out of all recognition, but I really just do find it quite offensive, you know, that everybody in Italy owns a vineyard or a little trattoria and like everybody lives in a small hillside town. I mean, I know this isn't Tuscany, but even so, you know, give us a city once in a while. You know, it's just catering to the lowest possible common denominator. Oh, Europeans have smaller cars than Americans? Ha ha ha! What the fuck? It just, like, let's move on, people. It's like the way when, you know, in kids' movies, when somebody comes to the UK, they instantly fall in with the aristocracy. Have you noticed this? Mm-hmm. It's this level of narrative complication. And I think it's bad. So I really went into this looking to have a nice, stupid rom-com time. Mm-hmm. I am here for a nice, stupid rom-com. But this insulted my intelligence with its stupidity.
5 stars then for You, Me, and Tuscany. We gave us 2, right?
We gave
2 stars?
Yeah.
Okay, 2 stars then for You, Me, and Tuscany. And on that note, that is it
for this week's Empire podcast. Join us next week for more film-related fun when Helen will be joined by nobody, just Helen in an endless void of existential angst.
I mean, maybe I could get some of the other staff to join me.
I mean, yeah, we could probably do that.
Okay.
I'm sure that can be arranged.
Or the existential angst.
Or the cardboard cutouts of me and James.
Tempting.
It is so tempting.
So tempting.
Andy Serkis in a mocap suit.
That'd be amazing.
Leo Woodall, 50% off. And either Brian Cox.
Amazing.
Fuck off. Who will be making his directorial debut with Glenn Rothen, which is an exceedingly Scottish film from an exceedingly Scottish man, or Jack Rayner, who is the star of Lee Cronin's The Mummy. It'll be one of those on the main show. The other one will be in next week's episode of The Interview, so keep them peeled for those as well. But in the meantime, all that remains is to say goodbye to my three colleagues of such lethal cunning. As Logan Roy once said, I love you, but you are not serious people. Goodbye to James Dyer.
Goodbye, Chris.
Goodbye, John Nugent.
Goodbye. Au revoir. À demain.
Oh, my God. He's really bringing out. Yeah, that chouette has taught you well. It's goodbye from Helen O'Hara.
Ciao a tutti.
What?
What? I'm...
What? How dare you?
Reggae Sean Page is allowed to be Italian and I'm not.
He's Reggae Sean Page. Have you seen him?
I mean, I...
Look at him, walk around him.
I mean, that's fair. I married an Italian. I'm allowed to, you know...
You did. You did marry an Italian. Yeah.
Yeah, it's fine.
Just like you, me, and Tuscany.
Just like.
So many ways.
So he also owns a vineyard and a hilltop villa.
I think this is why you don't like the film, because they took so much of your life.
Of my life, that's right. Yeah, very, very much so.
The wanting to be a chef.
Super into cooking. Yeah, that's me.
Falling in love with someone's cousin.
No, well, I mean, I guess he's someone's cousin.
He is someone's cousin.
Yeah, not someone I'd previously, you know.
And you, Helen, correct me if I'm wrong. You have a small car.
I do have a small car. Oh, my God.
Everything is falling into place.
They stole my life.
Or as they say in Italy, plaza.
That's not what they...
And on that note, it's goodbye for me as well. There's just one thing left for me to do this week. Sam, get running, pal.
No, Chris, no.
It's time for the ritual.
Oh, God.
What?
We're not paying him.
No murder.
Bags the bow and arrow.
Yes. Bagsy the Wicker Man. John, what's your implement of choice?
I'm not participating.
Sam, how fast are you?
Guess we'll see.
We'll give you a 30-second head start. How's that sound?
Great.
All right. Thanks for listening. See you next week. I'll be in prison. Bye.